This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Trainer Todd Pletcher has reached the stratosphere.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Moon over Miami for Bill Mott.
3,000 for trainer Mark Cassie.
Trainer D-Way Lucas, a 6th win.
And Bob Baffert with another incredible milestone.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Win number 1,000 for the great Trevor McCarthy.
Here's 2,000 for Nick Zito.
Steve Asmussen is now North America's all-time leading trainer.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone. Happy Wednesday, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again, and very happy to be back in the saddle with you for the next hour all across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and of course streaming live or podcast. And if you're listening that way, you're doing it through our HRRN website, horseracingradio.net. Well, today's guest is going to be calling it a career after more than four decades of training. But trust me, he won't be leaving the racetrack nor this sport that he loves so much. The 72-year-old born in Riverdale, New York, is retiring from training on his own to work as an assistant trainer in Kentucky for his longtime friend, Hall of Famer Shug McGahee. Now, to date, this gentleman has saddled 1,256 winners with purse earnings of nearly $54 million. Those victories, by the way, include 186 stakes, 85 of those coming in graded stakes races, including the 1990 Preakness with Summer Squall and the 2003 Horse of the Year, Mineshaft. And I can tell you this, on a personal note, he is one of the nicest, most approachable, and humble people you will ever meet in the sport of thoroughbred racing or anywhere, for that matter. Please join me in welcoming trainer Neil Howard to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Neil, appreciate the time, my friend.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
You know, this is simply the next chapter in the career of Neil Howard. There was no way on earth that you were ready to ride off into the sunset and put your feet up in a rocking chair on the front porch somewhere.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I just something that I guess everybody gets in a different way, gets to that point and in their careers. And but I kind of been thinking about doing something like this. And but, you know, the opportunity, I knew when the opportunity came up, it would kind of come up kind of all of a sudden. That's how those things work, especially in this business. So when it did come up, I kind of jumped at it, for lack of a better term.
Well, when you have a guy like Shug McGahee come to you and bring this up to you, and I guess maybe that's how it worked. If it was the other way around, let me know if you went to Shug. But, you know, when that connection is made with a person like Shug McGahee, who is just not only a fantastic trainer but a wonderful person, man, it's right. Tough not to jump at that opportunity, Neil.
Yeah, it was exactly. It was one of those situations where, you know, Shug and I have been friends. We kind of started out kind of in pretty much a lot of similarities in the way we started out and the careers we had, you know, from an internal standpoint, you know, with the kind of people that we learned from and a lot of the clients that we were, that I think, at the risk of putting words in his mouth, the kind of clients that we were so fortunate to become employed by. There were a lot of similarities there, but Shug and I have had some conversations about things at large, about the business, which everybody has those conversations about different things with their friends. And Shug, being as perceptive as he is, you know, I think he kind of thought, you know, giving me a call probably would be, I think he knew without me ever telling him that might have been something that was in the back of my mind. But I also feel that he felt that there was be no harm in reaching out to me.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that he did. It was just kind of one of those things that kind of came about just on its own, and everything kind of just fell in place. Like I said, it was a short conversation.
You mentioned, Neil, that you had been thinking about making this type of move for a couple of years now. What things led you to start having those types of thoughts about doing something a little bit different?
You know, things change. The nature of this business, it's a business of a lot of change, I think more so than a lot of occupations. The millions and millions of occupations that are out there, there's a lot of change in this business, and that's what makes this business so challenging and so wonderful, and there's so much to it. But I just wanted to things change. I went from I have to stress, you know, I was in the minority. I was so fortunate to come, you know, to come to work for the Farishes. You know, that doesn't happen. You know, I was very, very fortunate, and they were responsible for me being able to have a career that you could only dream of, and having that professional and personal relationship with people such as the Farishes was just, again, you can only, you know, I know myself how fortunate I was. But having said that, I just had been thinking that I could never, ever quit working or not doing this kind of work on a daily basis, but I wanted to kind of do it in a different capacity. But it was one of those things. I was thinking about it quite often. I would think about it, but then by feed time in the afternoon, I'd forget about it, you know, that kind of thing. So,
yeah.
You know, which I'm sure everybody goes through that, you know. But then it was one of those things that when I got the call, when Shu called me about 10 days ago about this, you know, it was one of those things that I've been in this business kind of taught me. I know when to go and when not to go on my gut feeling, because the hardest part to learn when you're coming up as a trainer, when you're first starting out, is this kind of thing. You know, should I run? Shouldn't I run? Should I scratch? Should I not? You know, off the turf, on the turf, blah, blah, blah. When you start hem-hawing, that's the worst thing. There was never even a doubt that I was going to do this when I spoke to Shug. I just had to exercise self-control and waiting about 5 to 6 hours to call him back and tell him, look no further, you know. So it was just a combination of things. You know, my things changed. My bond was reducing a little bit in numbers. The business models have changed in the industry with a lot of partnerships now are giving people that otherwise couldn't get involved with buying young horses and better stock and different partnerships. The general partners in these partnerships, they have different agents that they use, different trainers that they use, and sometimes you're involved, sometimes you're not. But the business has been so good to me, and the bottom line is I'm very comfortable with the career that I had, and I wanted to keep that intact. And I thought this was a good way to accomplish two things: do that, and at the same time, still do what I want to do every day. And do it, you know, for a person first off, such as Shug, and a trainer such as Shug. So it really was kind of a as I say, I know I've said this five times already, but it was a short conversation.
Yeah, talking with trainer Neil Howard here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. If you are just joining us, Neil will be stepping away from his role as a full-time trainer to take a job in Kentucky as Shug McGahey's assistant trainer, and they have been friends for a long time, and he was just talking about some of the similarities with their careers. Neil, you had that wonderful relationship with the Farishes, and they did a lot for you and a lot for your family and for your career. Shug had the Phipps family, who did an awful lot for him and for his career. So even from that perspective, there is wonderful synergy there between the two of you.
Yeah, very similar. You're 100% right. I can't add anything to that.
Yeah.
And on that note, you know, I have I'd like to feel like I have the knowledge and the background to operate the way Shug wants to operate, which is in a very quiet and unobtrusive manner. Just go about your business, focus on what you're doing, taking care of the horses, and it that part's simple for me.
We're going to spend a lot of time talking about your background and how you got started. We'll go back to the early days of Neil Howard, but since we brought up that relationship with the Farishes and since Will Farish and his family meant so much to you and to your family, tell me a little bit more about how that relationship began back in the early 80s. What do you remember about the first time that you got that phone call or ran into them for the first time?
Yeah, well, my association with Mr. Farish was 100% a result of Mike Klein, who just retired, Mr. Farish's long time farm manager.
Yeah.
And who Mike had been in involved with and taking care of Mr. Farish's mares when Mike was managing Big Sing Farm before Mr. Farish opened up when Lane's End was just being developed. And Mike and I used to had worked on the racetrack together for Mac Miller. And actually, Mike even was responsible for getting me the job with Mac Miller, which turned out to be kind of a turning point for me in the business. And that's where I feel like I got the education of a lifetime, not so much with the horses, but just also how to carry yourself, how to interact with people. And because, you know, Mac Miller, there's cliches all over the place, but there was a reason they called him the gentleman trainer. And because he was, and everybody he approached, everybody that approached him, he was just to watch him around people was just, it was a treat in itself. And you learn a lot by that, you know, watching and not saying too much. That's the way you learn. But anyway, so, but in my first job on my own, when I left Mr. Miller to go on my own, I had an opportunity to get started in Ohio and the Ohio circuit. And my wife's boss, P.G. Johnson, who she was galloping horses for, was responsible for me getting that job. And wow. And after a few years of doing that, I wanted to kind of we wanted to go to Kentucky and kind of change things around a little bit. We knew that's where we might be a good idea that would help us take the next step. And Mike had talked to me about coming to work at Lane's End Farm, and that's just shortly when Lane's End opened. He told me Mr. Farish had his visions were just unlimited on what his plans were, and he thought it'd be a good idea for me to come to work at the farm, which I did. And I mean, Mike didn't paint me any big pictures or tell me that I'm sure this will happen or that'll happen, but it did happen. This happened and that did happen. I worked there, and there was a circumstance that occurred, and a situation opened up for me when Bill Carroll, one of Mr. Ferris's greatest friends and trainer, he had a terrible accident at Keeneland and lost his life. And so Dell Jr. was training for Mr. Farish in New York, and kind of a thing, there was an opening there with the terrible loss of Del Carroll, and I took that fall, I took the yearlings to Camden, South Carolina, and broke that group of yearlings with nothing. In other words, at that point, it was just going to Camden, breaking the babies, probably coming back to the farm, working the season, and maybe starting to do that. But midway through the winter, Mr. Farish had talked to me about some of those two-year-olds that had to go to Kentucky, that I could, if I wanted to, I could stay with them. And that's what happened. Went to Keeneland, and I trained for them ever since then. For the next 30 some odd years, I was working for Mr. and Mrs. Farish and the whole family. So and the rest of it, really, it was a story that you could, I mean, it was just something that, it was a lifetime dream come true, basically.
Yeah, it certainly was. What a story, Neil. You ever think about where your career might have ended up had you not walked into that role with the Farishes?
You know, I do, in the sense that I know it wouldn't have turned out to be what it was.
Yeah.
But, in this business especially, if you have a work ethic and you treat people nice, things usually come your way. I'm sure we would have made it, Sue and I, but I don't think it would have evolved into what it did, or I'm sure it wouldn't have. You never know the unknown, but I'll always and for that reason, being associated with Mr. and Mrs. Farish and the Farish family all those years, and accomplishing what they enabled me to do. You know, that mean it's something that it's the most important thing, and it's something. So I want to make sure whatever I did, when the time came for me to maybe make a change, I wanted to do everything that I could in a way that I could keep that intact. And I feel like by doing this, it's a way for me to still do what I love doing every day with a person that I have, you know, unlimited respect for, and at the same time, kind of keep intact what I accomplished.
Neil, how would you describe the Will Farish approach and philosophy to owning and breeding and raising good horses? Because Lord knows he's had so much success in this sport.
Yeah.
What allows him to do that, or has allowed him?
Yeah, I think a lot of his approach, when I think about it now, had a lot to do with Mr. Farish's fascination with history and when it, which kind of, I know that's just a general term, but just listening to Mr. Farish talk about, you know, he's a genius when it comes to breeding. Some of the things he used to say, I used to come away and say, man, who would have ever thought of that? You know,
yeah.
But I do that all the time with him. But I think a lot of his historical nature kind of probably resulted in him, in Mr. Farish becoming what he had, in Lane's End becoming what he had, and like you say, be it's world renowned in the breeding part of it. It just, generations families and the meticulous, you know, picking apart pedigrees and what horses had done relative to their how far they ran, the surfaces they ran on, and it's very hard. It's very hard to put in words, to be honest with you, there were so many things, and Mr. Farish's, his business acumen, and of course his, the way he interacted with people. I mean, it was just watching him. It was just very special, very special. I think a lot of it's hard to explain, but again, you know, he was so his interest and passion about breeding was just it was undeniable. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, I think the word visionary could certainly apply to somebody like Will Farish. Yeah, especially hearing your description of his approach and his philosophy. You also, Neil, had the privilege of being associated with another true visionary in our sport. He is no longer with us. That is Cock Campbell and his Dogwood stable. Tell me a little bit about that relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. He was a visionary, obviously. And I'm sure the road you're going down is how he kind of was. I think most people would say that he was responsible for really, for partnerships and
yes.
bringing big groups together really, really became the order of the day. And a lot of it was because of the models that Mr. Campbell put forth. But Mr. Campbell, actually, I came to Mr. Campbell came into my life also by way of Mr. and Mrs. Farish, starting with Summer Squall. And that was Mr. Campbell bought Summer Squall for the Dogwood Partnership from Mr. Farish, from the Lanes End consignment. And Mr. Farish had retained a part of Summer Squall, and Mr. Campbell so graciously asked Mr. Farish if it was possible that he could send me the horse when he was ready, you know, when he was ready to come to the races. And Mr. Farish so graciously agreed. And of course, I was training private for Mr. Farish at the time, but Mr. Farish was a part owner of the horse. And Mr. Campbell was unique also in a different way. He was a very personable man, him and Mrs. Campbell, two nicer people you couldn't have met. And, you know, and I had learned a lot too from Mr. Campbell also, like I did about interacting with people, just the business in general. But Mr. Campbell was very, very to the point. You could shoot straight with him about everything. You know, it was easy. It was easy sledding with him because, like Mr. Farish, because they wanted to know what was what, make the right business decisions. It's, you know, in a proactive way, and they became when I changed over from a private to a public stable, and I was still training for Mr. Farish publicly, but when I became public, Mr. Campbell immediately sent me a few horses to help me out and keep my stable going. And he appreciated, you know, Mr. Campbell very much appreciated loyalty like Mr. Farish. And so I've been not only Mr. Campbell and Mr. Farish, but all the to that end with Mr. Farish, I came in contact on a professional and personal basis with people like Mr. and Mrs. Kilroy, Mr. and Mrs. Hudson. The list is just, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Temple Weber. The list is so long, I can't even remember now, that all the people that I had the pleasure of having horses in partnership with Mr. Farish. That was all a result of the Farish's partners, and it's just, you know, people like that. You just, again, I've been so fortunate. I can't overstate it enough.
Yeah, you know, Neil, listening to you talk about those people, and boy, you have mentioned some incredible names in the history of our sport, and you've had the privilege to be associated with those folks. And to hear your story and to hear you talk about, you know, Mike Klein and the introduction that he made for you, everybody in this business, we look at you now and we say, Neil Howard, yes, he's trained all these winners. He's won all these grade ones. He's trained a horse of the year. But everybody starts somewhere. How much different is it today getting started as a horse trainer than when you broke into the profession years ago?
I think it's different in a way that it used to be a little different. There, if you I'm trying to think of the best way to put this. Quite often, a young trainer would get started when the person that he worked up the ladder with would cut back or retire, and you would a lot of times a trainer would recommend to his owners, which were only a few owners at the time. The relationships were different then. They were less. Usually it was a single owner or a handful of owners that owned their own horses. You didn't have a lot of partnerships that there's absolutely – it's been a great innovation, don't get me wrong. I mean, you might have horses today that are owned by 40, 50 people. That's a common occurrence now, as you know. You know, you look at that stuff more than I do. But I think that trainers were more apt to get rolling on their own with from the owners would be passed down, for lack of a better term. I mean, because a lot of the trainers that I watched start out on their own in those days, when you walk in their barn, the only thing that would be different would be the trainer, be the same equipment, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing, which was good, which was great. But things have changed from that a little bit, I think, because of the different business models now, if that makes any sense. I don't know if I'm explaining that as good as I could.
Sure.
I think that's part of it. So it has gotten difficult. But I also think, though, that if you carry yourself the right way and work hard and show respect, usually you're going to wind up, you know, that's probably the best way to get started. And so, but it's a little harder in some ways, but easier in other ways, because nowadays there are a lot of programs out there now. A lot of the U of L equine program, for one. I know there's others, the Arizona program. There are a lot of programs out there now, like the Flying Start program, that are producing wonderful, wonderful. The horsemanship that you learn from these programs now is second to none. But it's still even though technology has really kind of taken over to a point, I still feel comfortable that the hands-on with the horses in the stalls and is still the order of the day to a point. You still have – you've got to have your technology skills much more than you ever had to have before. You know, the kind of the days of the pencil and pad that I'm still using are kind of going away.
Yeah.
But so I think it's a little bit of both. I don't know if that answers your question good or not. But
yeah, 100%. I completely understand. I'm visiting, by the way, with trainer Neil Howard here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Boy, has he come a long way since saddling that first winner, Knock Knock Bird, who paid $43.60 to win at River Downs May 27th, 1979. It's been one heck of a ride for Neil. We'll continue to talk about his story when I return. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
nominations are still open for the Phasic Tipton November Sale, the world's premier breeding stock event. Last year, the sale produced the 8 highest-priced fillies and mares sold at any U.S. breeding stock sale, led by Monomoy Girl, selling for $9.5 million. 22 horses sold for $1 million or higher, and the sale also produced the co-highest-priced weanling sold in the U.S. last year. Nominate your best today to the Phasic Tipton November Sale, a night of stars, Tuesday, November 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you sell? The test of time. There is no better example than Millridge Farm. Founded in 1962 by Alice Chandler, this year's inductee into the Hall of Fame as a pillar of the turf, Millridge has raised or sold 36 Grade 1 winners, including 8 Breeders' Cup winners and 2 Horses of the Year since 2000. This Keeneland September sale, Millridge offers a quality group throughout the various books, led by leading stallions Uncle Mo, Curlin, Candy Ride, Gunrunner, Kitten's Joy, and several promising first-year sires. Millridge will be showing at Barn 11 starting September 10th. Millridge, standing the test of time. The richest meet in Oak Lawn's history begins Friday, December 3rd through Sunday, May 8th. The 66-day meet will offer more than $45 million in purses with 36 stakes races totaling $12.3 million, and all allowance races are now worth $100,000. Oak Lawn boasts the richest Triple Crown prep series in the country, highlighted by the $1 million Rebel on Friday, February 26th, and the Grade 1 Arkansas Derby Saturday, April 2nd, now offering a purse of $1.25 million. Learn more at oaklawn.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Summer School tries to go with him on the inside at Please Two. Summer School and unbridled. Summer School is playing the better of the two with a 16th to go. And Summer School has turned the tables on unbridled. It's Summer School and Cat J to win the Preakness.
Mineshaft opening up here. 2.5 lengths. Quest giving his all second. And a break of about 7 lengths back to Evening Attire Bird. They're coming into the final furlong. And it's going to be Mineshaft. Mineshaft. Routinely brilliant to win here at Belmont Park once again. He has won the Jockey Club Gold Cup, and he has done it with style.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna visiting with trainer Neil Howard, who will be retiring from training to join Shug McGahee as his assistant trainer in Kentucky. Talked about that in the first half of the program. We're going to look at some other storylines associated with Neil Howard and his stellar career coming up in the second half of the program. You just heard two of the horses that will be forever linked to Neil Howard. That's 1990 Preakness winner Summer Squall. Trevor Denman had the call. And the 2003 Horse of the Year Mineshaft. Tom Durkin, of course, with the call of the Jockey Club Gold Cup. And what a special horse he was. What a special horse Summer Squall was. And they meant so much to Neil Howard and to his family. Going to tell you more about that in just a minute, right after I remind you that if you did miss any portion of this program, all you have to do is head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts, or tune in wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen there too. Neil, I have to tell you, listening to those two stretch calls again, boy, that brought back memories for me. I can only imagine what it did for you.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. You know, Mineshaft, of course, that's I look at this picture every morning when I leave my house.
Do you really?
No, I'm not being funny about that. I mean it.
I can imagine it would be very difficult not to look at that picture when you leave your house and not to look at it when you come into your house.
Yeah, well, my wife's got these blood horse covers with a few horses that we had on them, and his is hanging right. I mean, I look at it every morning when I walk out. I know that sounds funny, but I'm serious.
Not at all. Take me through, if I walk into Neil Howard's house, what are some of the memorabilia and some of the things I'm going to see?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, we all have that, you know, basically. Well, we've got, you know, I was so fortunate, but we've got the, really it's Mineshaft and Summer Squall you know, which everybody has those couple of life, not everybody, but I was fortunate to have not one, but two horses of a lifetime. But, you know, specifically Mineshaft in my personal opinion. So we have a lot of pictures of him all over, and you got things to look at that remind you about it. You know, you have one thing about this business, though. You know, you can't look at yesterday, as you all know. You got to be looking for that first race today, you know, and tomorrow, you know. But it's nice to kind of know that you did the job and you were able to accomplish a few things.
You know, it's funny because it's funny, Neil, because you're 100% right. And I've had so many trainers tell me that on this program, that you can't look back. You're always looking forward. And at some point, when things are wrapped up, you'll be able to sit back and reflect upon all the great moments that you've had. But the cool thing about Trainer Talk this afternoon is that we do get the opportunity to look back on some of the top moments in your career. And Mineshaft provided you with so many. When you hear the name Mineshaft, just what are some of the immediate things that come to mind about him?
Well, you know, it was kind of interesting. That horse, he was a very interesting horse because I really learned what, you know, when they say good horses act different, and he demonstrated that every single day that I had him for the 2 years I had him. And from the day he came into my barn here at Churchill, from when he came over from England, he would been up in quarantine up in Newburgh, New York for a couple of days. And when he got off the van, the thing that sticks in my mind more than anything, and I've told people this before, and I remember telling Mr. Farish, you know, when I called him when the horse first arrived, he acted from the minute he walked in the barn like he'd been there all his life. And literally, you know, I know this might sound a little over the top. I mean, the horse never put a foot wrong.
Wow.
That's just as simple as I can put it.
Wow. It's so rare, and that's why you described him as a horse of a lifetime. It's so rare to have a horse that shows that type of class and then delivers on the racetrack the way that he did.
Yeah.
You look at the way he wrapped up his career, Neil. He wins the Grade 1 Suburban. He comes back and wins the Grade 1 Woodward, then takes the Jockey Club Gold Cup, a third consecutive Grade 1. We just heard that stretch call. Do you have a couple of Mineshaft moments that stick out to you?
I mean, they all do, even though winning, you know, to win the Gold Cup and to cap off the year and pretty much almost at that point, we didn't know for sure, but that clinched his title. But, you know, the Jockey Club Gold Cup, again, for Mr. Farish, that race, that to this day, at the risk of putting words in his mouth, I think that's one of the most important races in the world to him. And obviously he won it twice now. You know, I won it and should won it for him a couple of years ago. And you know, I thought really the race that the turning point race for him, I think was probably the Pimlico Special, the way he won that race in the slop. Although it did never shocked us that he, the pedigree, you know, suggest, you know, the whole pedigree loved an off track, but which was another conversation. But I just think that he's one of those horses you can't really. The moments to me with him was being around him more so than his races, because other than being nervous about every race, you always went over there confidently. But see, I knew that what this was going to be, what this could possibly be, because he came from one of the greatest trainers in the world, in John Gosden, who was a great friend of Mr. Farish, and who had the horse. And he told me, he said, this is your horse. He just needs the dirt. And I would ask, when I talked to John, I was nervous about it. He'd laugh. He said, no, just train him. Just train him. He's the horse. Just train him. And that's all he would say.
Wow.
And, you know, John, you know, he said he's a good horse. Just train him.
You know, I'm so glad you brought up the fact that, you know, being nervous before every race, because Nervous Neil Howard is kind of a nickname that you'll hear people say when they describe you, because when you're in the paddock, you're very intense, and it does come across as being a bit nervous and anxious. Were you nervous before a lot of the big races, Neil, or was it just intensity?
I think you're more focused, like most of us are, and it comes off as being a little nervous. I'm sure we all get a little bit nervous, because for me personally, and I may be able to speak for a lot of other people, I don't know, I've always had, I try to, you know, you have to be humble, and I have no problem being humble. But I will say this, one thing that's always resonated with me, and the thing that always gets me a little nervous or apprehensive is I'm so embedded in wanting to do well for the owners that I don't think it's just me. I'm sure you get satisfaction out of doing good for your owners, but I always wanted to do well, especially like for Mr. and Mrs. Farish. They understood the business so well, and they put so much into it that whether it was a maiden race or an allowance race, or whether it was the Jockey Club Gold Cup, it meant almost the same to them, no matter what. I mean, obviously it's going to be a little mean more to you and you win a grade one than a non-2 on a Wednesday. But I just always was over anxious, because I always wanted the owners to do well. I used to take such, the most enjoyable part for me was after a race, you did well, or won the race, and then watching the owners, how thrilled they were and how proud they were. There was nothing. That's one of the biggest things that I enjoy more than anything about doing this.
And a huge part of why you've been successful, because it's putting the owners first and putting their horses first, and then everything else falls into line after that. I'm visiting with trainer Neil Howard here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Neil, I want to talk a little bit more about Summer Squall, because a horse that obviously was second in the Kentucky Derby in 1990, very, very close finish in that one too, behind Unbridled, and then came back and took the Preakness Stakes. Tell me more about him and that run that he had.
Yeah, Summer Squall was unique in his own way, like each horse is. Summer Squall, as everybody knows, was a smaller, lighter type horse, but his constitution was like second to none. He was just that horse there, like Mineshaft, was so. And I'm not comparing the two; they were two different type horses, but he was so honest, that horse. I mean, it was just unbelievable the how genuine he was. And, class, being genuine, those are words that I always feel. You know, Mac Miller said, don't throw those words around too easy, because those horses don't come along that often. The ones that are genuine, the ones that have class. And it was always something that I kept in mind. But I think that we all have our certain horses through our careers that we could say that about, and certainly Mineshaft and Summer Squall, I think, can be thrown in that category. But that was the thing about Summer Squall. He was very honest, and especially in it, and it was never more apparent than when he won the Hopeful for a small horse that was about 900 pounds or whatever he was, and to do what he did on it, you know, in all his races, but especially a race like the Hopeful, where he had to kind of squeezed through a hole. That was just, yeah, you have to watch that race. It's hard to describe it. And so it was, that's really about what I can, my main, that would be my main opinion, my biggest opinion about him, his honesty.
He, you know, he also gave you that first taste of your, the first taste of the Kentucky Derby in 1990. And even though he was second, right. I know you were very proud of him. Yes. And then he comes back and wins the Preakness. Tell me about being at Churchill Downs that day and your emotions, and then moving forward to the Preakness 2 weeks later, and what that was like to see him actually cross the finish line first in the Classic.
Yes, it was fantastic. I mean, as we every trainer, whether they want to admit it or not, that's, we always think about the Kentucky Derby, and then to finally get on the Derby trail and then make it to the Derby, because you never realized or dreamed it would be, it would feel the way it felt, the pressure, the excitement / nervousness. but it was absolutely a thrill of a lifetime. And to add to the fact that, you know, when you have a horse kind of make the lead a little bit at the quarter pole and he's still running, you know, and finishing as well as he did to be second in the Derby. And also, I also had the pleasure of kind of going through a few of those races, like even a couple of races, like the Bluegrass, you know, with somebody like Carl Masker, who's always been held in the highest regard in the industry. And then going on to the Preakness and things kind of being reversed, it was just, I knew, when I think about it now, I'm not sure if I knew how big it was, to be honest with you, at the time. I knew it was, you have to train, you have to do things the same, but it's just so hard to describe. When you're running in the Classics, it's a different ball game altogether. And I think any trainer that's been in it would tell you that you really can't put your finger on it, but there's something about it. But of course, winning the Preakness, and I would honestly say it probably resonated with me, fully resonated with me kind of well after I left that room, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that win in the Preakness came 11 years after your first career winner, Knock Knock Bird, and I mentioned that horse as we were going to the commercial break. I also mentioned the fact that he paid $43.60 to win at River Downs on that day in 1979, and Neil Howard's career was off and running. But, Neil, I joked with you during the commercial break. I said, how on earth did we get $43.60 on Knock Knock Bird that day? And you said, well, it's a new trainer just starting out. Nobody knew who we were. Tell me about the early days of Neil Howard and that win and having your wife by your side.
Yeah, it was fun for us. A little nerve wracking. I remember we got started and I'll never forget it because we bought what equipment we needed and rented apartment in Cincinnati, got there, got our feed tubs and water buckets and got our stuff. And then we got our barn set up at River Downs, start out with 7 horses there. I remember we had like, I think it was either $216 or $316 left in the bank when we got started. But we couldn't have been enjoying it more. We were nervous to start out with. And then, it was fun coming to River Downs, meeting some new people. But, you know, to this day, I always felt like this. That's another thing that resonated with me. I remember that going somewhere, didn't really know that hardly anybody there, but you just starting out on your own with a few horses. And everybody, the first day we started training, as soon as we got in the barn, I remember immediately, how you doing? Where you from? You know, what kind of horse you got there? You know, talking to you like they knew you all your life. didn't know him 5 minutes.
Yep.
And that's when I said, you know what? There's no cooler place in the world than the racetrack. I love it.
Didn't you tell me that your wife, Susan, was galloping at that time, but she was pregnant when she was doing it?
Yeah. She got pregnant while she was working. But I said, look, honey, you got to keep riding. Wow. She said, oh, I know, you know, so that was, you know, that was all part of like every starting a family or at River Downs. And, but it was fun. And of course, you know, having that built in top exercise rider really helped.
Yeah. You had what? $300 in the bank, Neil. You couldn't afford to pay an exercise rider.
Oh,
she had to keep going.
No, and I wasn't paying one. Believe me. She'll be the first to tell you that, you know, but that's another conversation. But, it was fun. You're always a little nervous, obviously, because no matter how much you trained to do anything, as soon as you start on your own, you're going to be a little bit on edge about it, but it all worked out good. But the way people, you know, racetrack people, they're all about, we might be running against each other in the afternoon, but for the most part, there's not anything that another outfit or another trainer wouldn't do for you.
You know, that saying that says, you know, behind every good man is a great woman or something along those lines. And it's so true for you and for Susan and what you've been able to accomplish together.
Oh, it's not even, we don't have time for that conversation, believe me.
How about your children? Are they interested or involved in racing in any way?
No, other than loving what I did and coming to the races, our daughter rode show horses for a while because that's Sue's background. And she kind of lost interest in it, but it's a shame because she was a good rider. She took after our mother. But more just liking the races, but none of them really got involved in it.
What do you think, Neil, as you now do get a little time to look back and reflect upon these 42 years that you've been training horses, what would you say is going to be the one thing or maybe the couple of things that you're most proud of?
I tell you the truth, it just became apparent to me over the last few days by virtue of just like this conversation you and I are having right now. You know, first of all, the camaraderie on the racetrack to me is unprecedented. It's unlike any other industry. I think that the people that have reached out to me when it finally became public what I was doing, some of the texts that I got from people, I read them about four or five times. And these are people, and one thing about people, racetrack people, they're not paying you lip service. They tell you what they think.
Yeah.
Yeah, good and bad, you know. And you know, it's really resonant. That's kind of, I think, what I'm over. Just what you're doing right now, calling me, having me be able to talk about what I've done and where I'm going, and people just being really when to have friends like that I've made on the racetrack, people in regular, because we're different racetrack people. We live a different life. All we think about is the horses, but we have so many friends, so many acquaintances that you make on the racetrack. I think that's really more than anything. Other than really, I will tell you, the owners that I've had and the relationships I've had, but the collaboration that Mr. Farish, that Mr. and Mrs. Farish and I had on all the horses through the years, especially Mine Shaft, would be the one thing that will always that I think about every day.
Talking with Neil Howard here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Neil, we're down to about the final 4 minutes of the program here, and it has been just a delight to spend this time with you, and can't thank you enough for the visit. But I like to wrap up the show typically by asking trainers to let me know something about them that people might not be aware of, other hobbies, other things they enjoy outside of racing. But as you talked about, racetrackers are different. We are committed to this sport and to the horse. I want to do it this way with you on this program today. I think we'd be remiss if, and I know I certainly would be, if I didn't thank you for your service to this country. People might not realize that right out of high school, you spent a couple of years in the Navy.
Right, right. That was a fun time. Made some good friends there, too.
Yeah, well, on behalf of myself and everybody at Horse Racing Radio Network, thank you for your service to the country and really appreciate you doing that.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mike.
So what would it be that Neil Howard enjoys doing away from racing?
That I don't play golf, but I'm addicted to watching it.
Who's your favorite golfer?
You know, I tell you what, this might sound like just kind of a funny answer, but I love watching professional athletes, how they act, like the Derek Jeters of the world and people like that. And I bring up highlights of top ball players on my phone all the time. Nobody even knows that when I'm by myself. Really, I like all the top, not just because they're the best ones, but the top dozen or so golfers. I just love to watch it. But I really, though, I'm a big baseball fan, big Yankees fan. But I could watch highlights of Derek Jeter. And really, my favorite player is Yadier Molina, the catcher.
Yeah.
And I love to watch their highlights and just the way professional athletes, you learn things too. You can learn too. That's kind of what I like to do and something that a lot of people probably don't know.
Yeah. Well, Neil, listen, I can tell you that this hour has been so enjoyable, and I started the program talking about you being one of the nicest, most approachable and humble people in the sport of thoroughbred racing. And I remember meeting you when I was working at Horse ID years and years ago at Keeneland before I even started on radio. And you always took time to say hello. I have never forgotten it. It left a lasting impression on me. And I can't thank you enough for spending some time with me here on Trainer Talk today.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you talking to me today and being so gracious. Thank you so much.
All right, my friend. All the best in the new chapter of Neil Howard. Neil Howard, fantastic. If you missed any portion, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast at your leisure and follow us on social media at HRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. Now for my producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton.